Find the 2014 program guide at abc.net.au/rn.
Hi folks, Waleed Ali here for RN Drive, and on the program tonight...
Restoring Victoria's finances has been very challenging. If budget surpluses were easy in the current economic conditions, everybody would have them.
In your face, everybody else in Australia, says Victorian Treasurer Michael O'Brien, delivered a budget today, and that state is in surplus. So what makes it so different? Why are they in surplus in the Commonwealth and no one else is? Indonesia confirms an asylum seeker boat turned back, but says that three extra people were on board.
My question is this something that Scott Morrison directed his department to do? Is this something Tony Abbott knew about?
Greens leader Christine Milne speaking there. Opposition spokesman Richard Marles first up on the show. Still no word from the minister, Scott Morrison.
Our family stays awake all night thinking of our daughter and all the other girls and what they're going through and where they're being held.
It's a translator speaking for the mother of one of the kidnapped Nigerian girls, speaking out following fears that many of the schoolgirls have been smuggled abroad. So who is Boko Haram, who've claimed responsibility for this? And how exactly did we get to this point? We'll look at that on the program as well. And then first, exclusive photos and now a police investigation. But of course, we'll take a highbrow ethical look at the biffo between television heavyweights James Packer and David Gingell. RM, your highbrow network. It's 11 past six and people are already tweeting and texting about it. Billionaire UFC, there's a reality TV show I'd watch, says James on Twitter. Yes, there you go. It's the flavour of it. But first, the crew of an asylum seeker boat turned back to Indonesia by the Australian Navy say that Australian authorities put extra people onto their boat. The Indonesian Navy sent out a news release overnight, had a detailed timeline of events surrounding the interception of a wooden boat on its way to Ashmore Reef last week. And what the crew said to investigators was that two Australian warships escorted them back to Indonesian territory, but they also put three extra people on board. No comment from Immigration Minister Scott Morrison today because it's an on-water matter, which means they don't talk about it. We are joined, though, by Richard Marles, Shadow Minister of Immigration, or for Immigration and Border Protection. Richard Marles, do you know who these three people are?
Well, I don't, Waleed, and I hasten to say this is an allegation which hasn't been tested yet. But I think what we need to hear now from the government is that this isn't so. We really need to hear a denial from Scott Morrison and from this government that this has not happened.
Why do we need a denial?
Well, because we need to know that the activities of the government are consistent with international obligations, with the covenants that we have and the conventions that we are a party to globally, and clearly putting people on an asylum seeker vessel, if that is, the substance of this allegation represents a new step in policy, if this is what's going on by this government.
Well, not necessarily.
And I think we need to hear that it isn't so.
Well, some of the reporting I've read, though, in Fairfax, now again, this is not confirmed, we have to say that, but some of the reporting I was reading in Fairfax was suggesting that they'd intercepted two boats and the extra three people came from another boat. So it's really just a turn back of two boats. It's nothing more complicated or sinister than that.
Well, the problem we've got here, Waleed, is neither you nor I know. We have absolutely no idea because the government isn't out there telling us. And what we need to have from the government right now is an absolute assurance that the way in which they are conducting affairs on the high seas at the moment is consistent with our international obligations.
Well, a minute ago you wanted a denial that this had even happened. So there seems to be a shift.
I think the point I'm making is that the allegations which were reported in the Fairfax papers this morning were such that we absolutely need to know that that has not occurred, that we haven't got extra people being put on an asylum seeker vessel and sent back to Indonesia. I mean, that would represent a new phase in the tactics which are being employed by the government, if it's the case, and I think we need to hear from the government now that that's not what's going on, and we need an assurance that they are behaving in a way which is consistent with our international obligations.
You're a shadow minister. You're in Parliament. Is there nothing you can do to find out?
Well, we have sought, I should say, an urgent briefing from the government about this incident so that I can find, as best I can, what's gone on here. But it's one thing to be briefing me, and it's one thing to be briefing parliamentarians. I think actually what we need to see from our government is openness with the Australian people. Everyone in Australia needs to have a sense of confidence that the way in which the government is going about its business is consistent with our international obligations.
Right, we're going to get to international obligations in a moment, but if you have the power to try to find this sort of information, I understand you've taken steps, but isn't it just then a matter of waiting until you get that information?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of waiting to hear from the government now that they are acting in a way which is consistent with our international obligations and the covenants to which this government is a party. I don't think it's, in essence, we should be waiting for me to be briefed in order for the government to assure the Australian people that they are acting in accordance with law.
And parliamentary inquiry, would you do that?
We need to know what's going on. And at the moment, what we've got is some allegations. I accept that they're untested, but it's precisely for that reason that we need to hear from the government right now. And the silence is deafening.
Okay, you keep saying we need to hear that they are not breaching international law. I'm intrigued by the interest in meeting our international obligations, given that we so regularly are told off for breaching them by the UN. And this is a bipartisan phenomenon. Indeed, we've been told off for the entire process of taking arrivals that arrive here and sending them to PNG, which was, of course, something that happened in the last throes of the Labor government. Why is it that we're so selective in how much we care about our international obligations?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of being selective at all. I think we need to be meeting our international obligations under the Refugee Convention in terms of providing people safe refuge who seek asylum in Australia. I think all the actions of the government, as it was under Labor, met that. But what is being alleged here, if it were true, would be a new phase.
I'm interested in the principle here.
We should be abiding by international law, by our international obligations.
Is it now Labor's position that when the UN says that some aspect of our immigration or asylum seeker policy is a breach of international law, even if that is something like sending people to PNG, it is now Labor's position that that policy should be changed to accord with international law as the UN declares it to be?
There's a whole lot of ifs and buts that you've put in there in terms of various participants in the debate declaring things to be consistent with international law or not. What I would say is this. The way in which Labor in power went about our business was to act in accordance with international law.
Not according to the UNHCR.
Safe refuge was provided in relation to all the steps and actions that Labor took. Now, if what is alleged were to be true, and we don't know that, but that's precisely why we need to hear from the government, this would represent a new tactic in what the government is doing, and we would need to hear an assurance from them, at least, that they believe that their actions are in accordance with international obligations, and we'd need to hear from them why they see that as being the case. But right now, all we're hearing is nothing. I mean, the silence is deafening, and it leaves all of us with a sense of no confidence at all that we are acting in accordance with international law.
Richard Miles, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Ali. Thank you.
Apologies for the quality of the line there. That's Shadow Immigration and Border Protection Minister Richard Marles. Your reflections welcome. 0418 226 576. Mark says, Richard Marles is huffing and puffing. I'm confident in the government management of this issue and do not feel the need to know more. Another text says, hopefully these three extra people are Australian politicians. What a great plan, though. Export with interest. Take that, Indonesia. I'll see yours and raise you. Scott Morrison's out of control. This is some contrasting views. 0418 226 576 or Twitter at RNDrive, and you can let me know what you think. I can confirm those three extra people were not Australian politicians. The reporting suggests that they were two Nepalese and one Indonesian who was a crew member, but that's yet to be confirmed. 18 past 6. No budget emergency in Victoria. Oh, no. Victorian Treasurer Michael O'Brien delivered his budget today. He promised not just a $27 billion construction blitz and payroll tax cuts. He also promised a healthy bottom line.
Over the past 3.5 years, the Coalition government has restored Victoria's budget from the structural deficit we inherited to the strongest state finances in Australia. The 2014-15 budget will deliver an operating surplus of $1.3 billion in 2014-15, growing to $3.3 billion by 2017-18.
I think Joe Hockey's a bit jealous. I think. I don't know. I'm not reporting that as fact. Tim Kolbatch joins us now, former economics editor of The Age newspaper. Tim, why is Victoria in this situation and no one else?
We've had a period of fairly cautious budget management by successive Victorian governments, both the former Labor government, of course the Kennett government to start with, the former Labor government under Steve Bracks and John Rumby, and particularly the Liberal governments under Ted Baillieu and Dennis Knapsayon. They've practiced pretty strict restraint on spending. In the forward estimates that they released today, they've got spending rising by 2 or 3% a year. That's pretty much in line with inflation, so the actual amount being spent is going to be very austere. They've really had a big backlog of works to be done, so that there is a lot of scope there for them to do projects that make a lot of sense.
Right, but looking at some of the figures, I mean, it's not that austere, is it, when you've got a $27 billion amount to be spent on construction? There is spending here, and it's odd to think that Victoria is the state that is doing this, because, of course, it's been the subject of so much economic concern with job losses. I know they're in the future, but nonetheless, a real concern that...
Oh, no, the job losses are in the present.
Well, there you go. That makes it even stranger, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think that creates the need for it. And the government was attacked for having sort of, a year ago, Michael O'Brien presented a budget which really punted everything on the east-west link and the eastern stage of it. And that really did not go down well with the vast majority of voters. And Labor put up a proposal for a much more diverse portfolio of infrastructure investment, and now that is what the Liberals themselves are planning to do. It's interesting, Waleed, how they plan to do it. There's a part of it is that they will fund it through the budget. They aim to have these budget surpluses up to about $3 billion a year by 2015-16. The way they do that is partly that they expect to get a lot of money from the federal government for infrastructure investment, but that money won't actually be shown as an expenditure because of the way that the budget papers are conventionally drawn up. You show your expenditure as being the expenditure on routine investments, routine activities like, for example, running schools, running hospitals, running rail lines. But the things that you build are on a separate little part of the budget and they don't show up as expenditure. So that $27 billion you just talked about will not be showing up on the budget papers as expenditure.
Right, that wipes out your surplus many times over, doesn't it?
Well, it's what the surplus is for, really. The surplus is designed to fund that, and Michael O'Brien's boasts today was that on the forward estimates, in the last 3 years of them, they will be paying for all the infrastructure investment that they undertake themselves for the budget. Now, the second thing there is that a lot of the new infrastructure investment will not be done by the government. It will be done by the private sector under PPPs. And that includes the new Melbourne Rail Link, or the redesigned Melbourne Rail Link that he announced today, which is very different from the original plan proposed by Labor, and very different again from the version that the Baillieu government had promised. It'll be a much smaller rail link in terms of the new stations it provides. It won't go up to Parkville and North Melbourne anymore. Nor will it go to Caulfield. It will just go from Southern Cross to South Yarra with two new stations at the new Fisherman's Bend extension of the city and one at the Domain. I'm not quite sure why, but...
It's a different model, though. It's a more modest proposal, I suppose, is what you're saying.
It's a much more modest proposal,
Is that ultimately a lesson that other states should be learning, then? Is Victoria taking an approach that's useful?
Because they realise that when you ask Victorians or Melbourne people what they would like most built, the most popular rail project turns out to be a direct rail link to the airport. Transport professionals would say that's the least urgent project because we actually have a pretty good bus service to the airport now. That's now been wrapped into the Melbourne Rail Link project so that it's been redefined to cover that new area through Fisherman's Bend and also the above ground project that will be built to Melbourne Airport.
So what does Joe Hockey think when he looks at this? Is he overcome with jealousy?
Well, he probably realises that he's going to have to pay for a fair bit of it because they're planning to take full advantage of the 15% bonus he announced for states that sell off assets. They're going to sell off the Port of Melbourne. They're selling off, or they've already concluded a deal to sell off the Rural Finance Corporation. And there's a fair bit of federal money coming in for both the old eastern stage of the East-West Link, the controversial one, and the less controversial western stage, which the government, state government committed to a couple of months ago. So that the feds would be paying for a bit of it. Yeah, Joe Hockey would be nervous. I mean, there's been no Victorian equivalent of the disability care.
Right, NDIS, yeah.
No Victorian equivalent of the Gonski report to add big, huge spending items ahead. And Victoria's taxes haven't taken the hits that company tax has from all the losses, and income tax too for that matter.
Yeah.
Both taken a big hit from the losses that investors made when the stock market crashed in 2008.
Right, and also the drop in prices and the mining boom as well, which wouldn't affect Victoria not being a mining state and the likes, so a range of factors. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate it. That's Tim Kolbach, former economics editor of The Age. It's 26 past 6. Nation, for years we've wallowed in disappointment. We've wallowed in disappointment about the fact that although we are a great nation, there is one record that has eluded us thus far. I think you know what I'm talking about. Biggest beer bottle in the world. We don't have it. You'd think we would. We got the big banana. We got the big pineapple. We got the giant koala. We got a golden guitar. We do big things. And as a country, I think it's fair to say we do beer. But not the biggest beer bottle in the world. That honour goes to Denmark at 25 metres. Well, Nation, I'm here to tell you that that might be about to change if my next guest gets his way. MacArthur Grange Breweries is the relevant company. It's behind the idea for a 30-metre-high beer bottle in the New South Wales regional city of Goulburn. That would smash the record. Another 5 metres. That's 20% extra. And the director is Anton Spitalak, who's joining me now. Anton, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Philippe, for having me on board.
You want to make history here?
We do. We want to make something the biggest.
And beer bottles. You'd think that someone would have thought of this before, but no, they haven't. Goulburn, though, is the place. Why do you think Goulburn is particularly an appropriate site for the biggest beer bottle in the world?
Well, it's very appropriate for us because that's where we're going to put our brand new brewery.
Well, sure, but it's got to be culturally appropriate. As I understand it, this is a big beer bottle that you would be placing at the entrance to the city of Goulburn. Is that right?
Right opposite the big marina, which is affectionately referred to as Rambo.
Yes.
And yes, it is, right off the highway on one end of town.
So, welcome to Goulburn. Here's a beer.
Here's a beer bottle right next to Rambo.
Okay, now, is this the kind of message the people of Goulburn want to send about their city?
I think it's a bit of fun. You know, we're just a bunch of rebels out there who are doing something different. We had a crazy idea to try and pull something off that was definitely going to make an imprint. And we said, hey, we'll just give it a shot.
Right, you can give it a shot. But there's imprints and there's impressions. Have you had a response from the locals yet about whether or not they want their town to be defined by a big beer bottle?
It has been an overwhelmingly positive response. Everybody seems to think that it's an amazing idea to try and do something this grand of scale, to really cast a very long shadow over Denmark's 25-metre-tall beer bottle, and people are really supportive so far.
How much tourism exactly are we losing to Denmark because of the big beer bottle?
Millions. Millions of visitors.
Have you quantified that? Do you have many modelling to show it?
Oh, we do. We have a very scientific model.
Oh, really? Can you take us through it at all?
We don't take ourselves too seriously, Waleed. I mean, we're out there doing something different. I mean, for us, for the last 100 years, big beer has kind of dominated the scene here in Australia, and it's all owned by foreign companies. We're a small artisanal producer, family-owned, Australian-owned, and for us, we're just looking to do something which is a bit wacky, a bit out there. The idea came across, we said, hey, let's give it a shot.
Yeah, well, wacky and out there, I think you've achieved that. Has the council got a response yet?
No, they're currently in the deliberation process. I believe it's still on public display for another week or so, and then they'll have some collecting of different approvals and comments from different agencies, and then they'll give us their feedback in a few weeks, I'd imagine.
And are you picking up a vibe at all from the council? Have they had public submissions?
I think they haven't had so many so far, nothing that's really come across our radar. To be frank, I mean, the council is really supportive of anything that will put Goulburn on the map and kind of drive additional traffic through. And I think that being right opposite a gas station, right opposite the big marina, which is in a fairly industrial area historically, is kind of a, maybe even a welcome addition if we can pull it off.
Right, but the big marina is a symbol of wool production. You can surely understand the symbolic problems that might occur where you're tying the symbol of the city or the town to beer. That basically, this is a town of drunks.
Well, I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, our products, our Stockade line of beers, are all natural. They're handcrafted in small batches.
Do they have alcohol in them?
Yeah, of course they do. Most beers do.
Isn't that the heart of being drunk? It's the alcohol, not the organic ingredients that surround it?
I don't know. I mean, for us, our beer drinkers, they tend to be kind of upscaling and drinking fewer beers than they would if they were drinking the kind of mass-produced, factory-orientated products that some of the larger guys put out.
Well, what happens if you don't get approval? Would you go elsewhere with both your beer bottle and the brewery?
Yeah, if they said you can have the brewery, you can't have the bottle. We're not looking for you to make, you know, if we're not looking for you to have signage, we're not looking for you to bring people in, it will probably strike a chord against what we're trying to promote as a very kind of tourist-friendly destination of beer learning, which will be our touring facility inside the brewery. So probably we'll have to move somewhere else. But I can't imagine them coming back with a kind of black and white answer like that. They'll probably try and come back with some middle ground.
All right. We'll see what the locals make of it, Anton. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Philippe.
Anton Spitalak, who's director of MacArthur Grange Breweries. All right, Goulburn, you tell me. You into it? 0418 226 576. Is this just what this country needs to put us on the map? News desk. Let's get the latest headlines. Here is Colin Denovan.
Yes, thank you, Waleed. The federal government is under pressure to scrap its deficit tax, with Cabinet to finalise the budget tomorrow. The proposed tax on high income earners is unpopular with some senior coalition MPs and apparently with the public, with a news poll showing support for the government has dropped 5 points in a month. The Victorian budget features $27 billion worth of infrastructure projects over the next 10 years, including money for two new rail lines through central Melbourne and the city's airport. The metro tunnel has been changed to run on a different route with two new stations as well as the rail line to the airport. It'll cost up to $11 billion and pre-construction work should start in 2016. The Reserve Bank has left the official interest rate on hold at 2.5% for the ninth month in a row. The last interest rate cut was in August 2013. The longest undersea tunnel in the world, the Channel Tunnel connecting Britain and France, is 20 years old today. The project, known as the Channel, has faced many problems, from fire to the threat of bankruptcy. However, it's still considered to be one of the greatest engineering feats of the 20th century. ABC News.
Seven minutes to 7. Just on that last story about the biggest beer bottle in the world, so it's been proposed for Goulburn. Ram bottle, says one text. What, you want to combine the ram and the bottle? There's a thought. Hadn't heard about the giant beer bottle, says Greg from Goulburn. Well, what do you think, Greg? It says he likes the beer. I'm not interested in that. But what do you think about, do you want your town defined by that, Greg? Let me know. Could anything be more crass than a giant beer bottle, says MD in St Kilda East. So cultural, says another text. The big Brussels sprout is coming to the Yarra Valley in Victoria, apparently, says Jeff in Hawthorne. I don't know if that's a joke. Really, the big Brussels sprout? Can't celebrate a Brussels sprout, can you? Really? Thank you for all of the texts as well on asylum seeker policy and also on the Packer versus Gingell bout. I'm going to talk about that a bit later in the program, and people have got different perspectives on this. It's great to see News Corp sponsoring the Packer versus Gingell bout, says one text. Three media heavyweights at their low rent best, says Graham. What do we expect out of someone who makes his money out of gamblers? The Packers have never been role models, says another text. They're tying it to a social issue. And John just says, did one of those two king hit the other? No, then it's boring and not news. Thank you, John. And another John says, the real question is, what were they fighting over? And I suppose in some ways, when you're talking about men that powerful and that rich, that could well be the real question. I'm joined now for a look at the markets by Annette Beecher, who's the head of Asia-Pacific Research at TD Securities. Annette, how do you think Singapore would react to the fact that Australia was home to the world's biggest beer bottle?
Well, and combined with brawling billionaires, you know, we're just lowering the stakes on a daily basis.
Oh, it's the place to be, surely.
Yeah, I'm not I'm not too convinced about that. I know Australia needs to diversify its sort of tourism appeal, but I'm not quite sure if that's the way to go.
Right. Well, I think you've got to be imaginative, though. And maybe you spent too much time in Singapore and you've lost the touch with the common Australian sensibility.
I'm not sure about that. My family and friends won't let me forget my hometown Newcastle roots, so I don't think there's a problem there.
Well, get back in touch with them, see what they think of the beer bottle, and let us know tomorrow. The Australian dollar, it's just the little battler, it's the little dollar that could at the moment.
Well, it's trying very hard to break out of its range. I mean, it's just nestled over 93 as we speak. It's only managed to briefly touch there in the last couple of weeks, and in fact hasn't been higher than that since the CPI report on the 23rd of April. So it's trying really hard to rally. Why is that? Well, as briefly discussed in your news report, the Reserve Bank did leave the cash rate at 2.5%. That is still a record low, and the bank is in no hurry to move it in either direction. But nevertheless, it was supported by, you know, several hundred words. And of some of those words, they seem to be a little bit more upbeat about housing construction, private consumption, credit growth is turning, exports are rising. So there's sort of a bit of a glass half full element to it. So I think that's given the Aussie dollar just a little bit of a boost. But it's happened more in London trading than Aussie trading, I have to say. And if you look at the Aussie stock market, it moved up and down along with the Aussie, but managed to close in the black, up 20.5418, and is up 1% so far this month. So it's looking pretty good. We've got a fairly steady currency, and we've got stocks rising. So all in all, the markets are still looking at Aussie as a favourable place to invest.
A win's a win. You take it, you move on to the next round, Annette. Thank you very
much.
Always
bank the win.
Indeed, you do. Annette Beecher, Head of Asia Pacific Research, TD Securities in Singapore. Waleed Ali with you for RN Drive. Everyone's on to big things at the moment. Judy's telling me that Brisbane had a big strawberry in the 1970s. I think the big pineapple is now closed, says Judy. Really? I didn't know that. And Anne says, what about the Darwin stubby? It's actually real as opposed to a statue. I can't even tell if you guys are joking anymore, or that's just Australia. 0418 226 576. Twitter at RN Drive. 7:23.
This is titled "The Genetics of Regret." I'm sorry I don't call. Sorry I lied about acid and the boy with the knife. The house full of beer rats. Sorry for the weevils and the dead grass. I'm sorry I don't call anymore.
Owning your own white guilt isn't cool yet. So you stuff the soft parts of other kids' cultures into your pockets until you believe it is not there.
Hip-hop, identity politics, and urban culture. New York City poets. You can stream Poetica from the RN website.
Change, but in the protest, the song's always the same, like the melody and the meter, and have you noticed that? Did you see that? That was on Q&A last night, ABC One. Student protesters, they managed to force the program to go off air temporarily. Yeah, passion's running very high on youth issues, clearly, and some of the members of the Socialist Alternative finally hatched a scheme to find their way into Q&A, I suppose. And you look back on it, how did it not happen sooner? But anyway, that's a separate issue. The question all this raises, with the budget next Tuesday, and the government clearly is keen to deregulate university fees, it's also considering cutting welfare payments for young people who aren't studying or working. This is part of the age entitlement thing. Is this appropriate?
Training and further education are now more widely available than they have ever been. And so there are greater opportunities for young Australians to participate in further education, technical, vocational, higher education, or to go into the workforce. We need to make sure that the incentives for young people aren't to sort of step away from education, training, or employment.
That's Scott Ryan, Parliamentary Secretary to the Education Minister, speaking to the ABC today. So here we go. A university fees, a higher university fees, and then less welfare, the best sort of policy to get young people on track and in control of their lives. Is this idea of earn or learn a fair ask? Well, we're going to try to thrash that out right now. Joining me are two guests. One is Julie Novak, who's a senior fellow with the Institute of Public Affairs, who joins us on the phone. And in studio, Deanna Taylor, who's the president of the National Union of Students. Ladies, thank you very much for speaking to us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Waleed and Deanna.
Thank you.
Julie, I might start with you. Earn or learn, this as a philosophy, does it work?
I recall the sort of specific sort of proposal being put forward by Twiggy Forrest, essentially suggesting that sort of people below the age of 19 apparently lose their welfare benefit if they're not in school or work. I have a little concern about that particular proposal, because what it actually does is further entrench fiscal discrimination within the broader sort of Australian welfare state framework that already exists. I mean, I would basically go toward a different proposal altogether, which would be basically to put sort of time limits on sort of, you know, work sort of sensitive welfare payments, particularly, for example, Newstart. So, for example, under that kind of regime, you know, basically people are entitled, let's say, like, for hypothetical sake, you know, a period of about 3 years or 4 years of receipt of Newstart, and then that's basically it. So, and that basically would cater for and be applicable to all age brackets, rather than this sort of discriminatory approach where you know, you have to earn or learn by a particular age bracket.
Right, I think you're saying that it's temporary welfare. I mean, if welfare is even the appropriate term, but it's temporary welfare once you leave school and or university for a number of years, and then that's it. That's the end of the story. Deanna, would that be an appropriate way of giving people an incentive, giving students an incentive to find work once they're done?
Students already have an incentive to find work. The issue is not that they don't want to work. The issue is not that they're lazy. Very often the issue is simply that there are no jobs available. Youth unemployment is a serious issue in Australia, particularly in low socioeconomic areas. And I'm not so certain, and I would argue it's not the case, that we should be penalising or implementing what really is quite harsh measures on one of the most struggling groups in society.
I might pause there and ask each of you to tell me what you think success here would look like. I mean, it's one thing to say we want to do things in the interests of students, whether it's providing them with a welfare payment or not. What are we actually trying to achieve for them? Julie?
Look, I mean, I think from my perspective, I would argue that ultimately the objective for younger people in Generation Y, as it were, is to basically sort of provide a broad economic environment and social environments as well, where basically sort of young people can participate as fully and as completely as they wish. And I guess from a sort of classically liberal perspective that I would that I embrace, I'd basically argue that not only in terms of sort of higher education sector deregulation, but deregulation across the board in terms of labour markets and housing and other areas of the economy would actually sort of be a boon for Generation Y.
What's so boony about it, I guess?
look, I mean, basically there, and I mentioned this in an opinion piece in the Canberra Times late last week, there are a number of ways in which governmental policies actually act against the best interests of young people. If we think about just the general position of young people as they are, and this is the case for every generation, they tend to have sort of lower levels of human capital, and that's a sort of contemporary issue, obviously, for today. And they basically just generally sort of have fewer work-relevant experiences. And I think the objective should be to basically unshackle young people from wanting to attain more work experience to build their human capital, and the way to do that is through, you know, labour market reforms, for example, abolishing minimum wage, ending occupational licensing that discriminate against young people, sort of lifting, improving housing affordability. And there's also that really sort of big sort of problem, I think, that's a long-term issue for young people, and that's the high levels of public debt in Australia. So there are a whole range of issues that I think artificially and quite unfairly restrain young people from achieving more of their potential more quickly.
So, Deanna, that's an interesting point, because once you go macro on this, you start to, I mean, it's one thing to say youth unemployment's high, it's another then to start proposing things to try to deal with that, but they might be potentially quite nasty things. I mean, if you lower the minimum wage, for example, then there would probably be less youth unemployment, but you wouldn't be earning very much. So what's preferable here?
Well, what's not preferable is seeing students or young people generally living in extremely harsh financial circumstances. We know that students, for instance, really struggle financially. Two-thirds of students currently are living below the poverty line. So suggesting that we embrace measures like reducing the minimum wage and effectively taking away the safety net that exists for young people and for low-income earners that's not the way we should be going. We should be finding ways to support young people when they're doing it tough and when they're not able to find work. Reducing the minimum wage is not the way to achieve
that. But how would you find them work, I suppose, is the question. Because the more generous you make that safety net and the higher you make the minimum wage, the fewer of them will be employed. That seems to be the way that the economics of the labour market, particularly at the entry level, works. So if you don't want to deal with the minimum wage question, or you don't want to lower the minimum wage, then what will you do?
Well, I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that what the government ought to be doing is finding ways to invest in burgeoning industries like renewable energy. We know there's going to be a lot of jobs coming out from that industry in the years to come. Other industries where employment is critical and where we can get young people into work. It seems to me that that's the way we should be going, finding ways to invest in industries that young people are going to find work. But more than that, putting in safety nets like Newstart and the minimum wage, so that if students or young people aren't at work or if they're in very low-paying work, they've got the support needed. And suggesting that someone who is on Newstart is any less incentivised to work because they're on Newstart and they're receiving a payment is not the case.
Well, what if they know the payment will run out, though? Would that give them an incentive to find work? Give them an imperative, like an urgency to finding that work?
As I said before, students already have an incentive to work. Students want to work. For one thing, they want to be able to put their degree that they've racked up an enormous debt for to use. Those degrees that they're studying are not for nothing, and they want to put those to use. So people have an incentive to work. They're not choosing not to. They're not. There's no lack of urgency in them finding work. There are structural issues at play that lead to them being unemployed. And this isn't about creating incentives to get them into work.
Right, and then the structural issues takes us back to the industrial relations argument we're having and so on. It becomes a very big question there. But there is something that Deanna said there, Julie, that I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And that is that people who, particularly when they go to university, they are studying for a professional vocation. That's what they're studying for in most circumstances, and they have qualifications for that.
Yeah.
Is there a worry if you create this incentive for them to find work as soon as they can possibly find it by taking away their Newstart or whatever it is and taking away the dole in certain circumstances, that they end up just settling for whatever is the short-term monetary need at the expense of building a long-term vocational future?
Look, I'm not convinced of that general argument, Waleed, because I think in a sort of broad sense, I mean, sort of young people are actively in a process of discovering just how best that they can basically create value for other people and therefore sort of find prospective sort of high-paying jobs for them. There's a really interesting sort of angle about this whole IR issue and education, which I'm finding particularly interesting right now. This is basically the area of occupational licensing. Now, I happen to talk on a fairly regular basis to young migrants who already actually have higher education degrees in their home countries, and they sort of find that there's a basic and very important skill mismatches. They can't find work, their preferred line of work, because basically they're required under Australian regulations to basically go through like basically a whole nother degree again, basically sort of wasting sort of 3 to 5 years attaining another degree in order to meet Australian standards when they already have a perfectly acceptable degree. So I do support Sir Deanna's sentiment very much that, you know, young people, you know, they're not lazy, not at all, not by any stretch, but there are government regulations in various circumstances which do hamper the best interests of Generation Y and young people.
Okay, just final word to you, Deanna, on those sort of regulations. Have you seen that as an issue for the students you represent?
The students, when we look at international comparisons, there is a large problem of students ending up in work that isn't in the line of work they were designed or intending to go into. I'm not so sure that the regulations that Julie was just proposing would address that. And I think putting a limit, as you were saying before, Waleed, putting a limit on the length of time that students can receive or young people can receive income payments before that lapses and they need to go and find work, I believe would lead to people ending up in work that they were not intending to go into, that they haven't been trained to go into, and it is significantly lower paying. And we see that in countries like the United States.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily what would happen here. I was just throwing it up as an idea, but you might end up working at Macca's instead of, you know, doing the hard yards unpaid at an accountancy firm or whatever it is that you want to do. I don't know. Well, I guess we'll see what the policy response is and then what the social consequences of that are. Deanna and Julie, I'm indebted to both of you. Thank you very much for sparing some time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Deanna Taylor, National President of the National Union of Students. Julie Novak, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs. 9 minutes to 7.
Now available as an All in the Mind podcast, The Psychopath Within.
So I'm like a borderline pro-social psychopath, I guess, but I'm a lucky one.
And can we treat kids who may be headed down the psychopathic path?
So there's children lacking in empathy, cold, tending to use predatory type bullying and aggression. And if something goes wrong, they just don't care.
The Psychopath Within on All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm. You can download or stream the program from the RN website.
So you've no doubt seen the images by now. Two media heavyweights boxing on like it's a boozy bar brawl. In fact, we've had some people pointing out that it's suddenly a very different thing, isn't it, when you've got these people doing it. David in Brisbane sends an interesting text. If it was two less well-off bogans, they'd have found themselves charged very quickly for such actions. If a schoolboy loaded the footage of a school brawl on the interweb, we'd be up in arms about it. What a great example we set for our kids when we're trying to discourage violence. And it is an interesting point. What is our attitude to this particular violence? This is the stoush I'm talking about between the Crown Chairman, James Packer, and the Chief Executive of the Nine Entertainment, David Gingell. It's a sub-editor's dream. I'll tell you what, it really, really is. Even New South Wales Premier Mike Baird weighed in.
Well, I have seen there was an incident in Bondi yesterday, and obviously the police are investigating it, but... Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not for me to comment other than I wouldn't want to be in the middle of those two.
What causes two close friends to come to blows like this? And what about two blokes fighting? What is it about that that's captured the public's imagination? Joining me for our weekly chat on religion and ethics today is Matt Beard. He's a moral philosopher at the Centre of Faith, Ethics and Society at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Scott Stevens would normally join us. Alas, he's not feeling well, but he has recommended Matt as a wicked bright young moral philosopher. Matt, is that you?
That's me. High praise. And just a shout out to Scott. I hope you're feeling better, Scott. Thanks
wicked
for putting
bright,
me up to
though.
This.
That doesn't get much better than that. Is there this, David from Brisbane's point, that the fact that these are rich seems to mean that it's treated slightly differently in the public imagination. Does that tell us something about it?
It does, but I actually think that's, we hear that a lot. We hear whenever there's a well-publicised instance, we say that, well, the ordinary person would be dealt with differently. And to an extent, that's true. It's worth pointing out the police are investigating this, but this is a biff between friends, and I actually don't think that it's not only the fact that these are prominent people, and it's certainly not the fact that these are wealthy people that's really capturing our attention here. I think there's something else that makes this interesting.
What's that?
Well, I think what part of what makes this, there's a few different levels to it. I think the first thing that makes this different to when an ordinary person sort of comes to blows, or when some more well-publicised instances of violence get let aside, say an NRL meltdown on a Mad Monday or a State of Origin biff, is because the context actually matters here. For better or worse, we've come to think that in certain areas, violence is a legitimate or at least an understandable way of communicating. But we don't think that violence is the language du jour of powerful business leaders. James Packer and David Gingell are two people who we expect to possess enough diplomatic nous to be able to diffuse a hostile situation without having to resort to violence, which is probably what they do every day in the boardroom. So I think the first level of our interest is just shock, indignation, and probably a bit of outrage that two prominent business leaders felt forced or lacked the necessary skills to be able to avoid violence.
So we have this understanding of violence as something that comes from weakness. And so when powerful people do it, then the whole moral character of it seems to change.
Well, I'm not sure that it's that violence comes from weakness. It's that violence is a last resort and an act of desperation. And we think that people who are leaders in a community, people who are affluent, successful, you would expect them to have enough interpersonal skills to be able to avoid violence just about all the time. Unless it's a genuine act of self-defense and someone's trying to mug them or take their life, you would expect them to have the means to resolve this in some other way. I think that's what the first thing that's really surprising about this.
Okay. And the second?
I think the second thing that, not that surprising, but what interests us about this is just good old-fashioned schadenfreude. I think we're enjoying the misfortune of the fact that these two people have had this publicized. We're enjoying it, perhaps especially for James Packer, but mostly for both of them. This is just, on some level, a simple case of tall poppy syndrome, which every wealthy or famous person in Australia has always got reason to fear. And there's a sense of hubris about it as well, I think, where we're enjoying the misfortune because in some sense we think they deserve it. This is two prominent businessmen behaving childishly in their personal life who weren't able to resolve this in a mature, responsible manner. And not only is this unbecoming of their profession and their station, but it just so happens that they've been caught out. And so all of this public embarrassment and interest is exactly what they deserved. I think there's a sense of hubris and justice in schadenfreude about this as well that makes us really interested in what's going on.
Does that take it outside of tabloid territory and make it something else that we can justify to ourselves?
No, I think it is still tabloid. I think there is always, when we see this type of thing, a kind of self-righteousness about the person who's making the judgment. And in this case, part of that righteousness will be we're justified in making this judgment because these are people who shouldn't need to resort to violence. And I think that's legitimate. I still think it's gotten more media attention than it deserves, but there are a number of levels that we can tap into this on. And this is just this isn't just another instance of two public figures having an argument on Twitter or a war of words through the press. This is actually violent, and that's the third part that's interesting, I think, is that this isn't just a public breakdown between prominent figures, but it's actually where the two people have come to blows. It's sorting out differences in the most primal way that we possibly can.
Does that make it immediately illegitimate?
Well, that's an interesting question. Not all violence is illegitimate. I think that what we need to understand before we can figure out whether it was legitimate or not is what was the kind of violence that was going on here. And I think part of the reason that we're all tapping into this, and part of the reason we tap into violence generally, is that violence is actually a form of communication. It's a way in which we talk to one another. I think we intuitively know this, even if we don't talk about it very much. Whenever we see violence, whether it's a drunken brawl on the street, a riot in the Ukraine, or even an act of terrorism, one of, if not the very first question we ask, is why did this happen? Mm. What was the purpose of the violence? What was the source of the dispute? And I think part of the reason we're trying to understand basically the epidemiology, the source or the cause of the violence, is because we want to know what the violent actor wanted. There's this sense in which the person who acted violently wanted to be heard, And on some intuitive level, we're all trying to listen. And I think in this case, we're still trying to, we wanted to figure that out. We wanted to know what the source, what the cause of this violence and this communication was.
But is our listening in this case akin to gossip?
I think so. I think this is in some sense a private conversation. What was happening was that these were two people, two friends, it's worth noting, who were trying to communicate with one another. And so our interest in this or our participation in this is at least on this level of violence as communication and not as a form of a legal issue or a social justice issue or anything like that. But just purely looking at it from this violence as communication standpoint, I think we are being very voyeuristic, and I don't think that the violence was aimed to communicate anything to us.
No, I suspect that's not the case. In fact,
our analysis of that violence is always going to be removed and a little bit kind of gossipy and voyeuristic.
Necessarily. And of course, the fact they're powerful adds a whole other layer to it as well. Matt, thank you for being so wicked bright for us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Moral philosopher at the Centre for Faith, Ethics and Society at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. News time, 7 o'clock.
Miss your favourite show? Then listen online at the RN website.
It is 5 minutes past seven. Waleed Ali with you for RN Drive through till 8 o'clock. Please hang around. We're going to talk more about violence actually in the drawing room. This time, violence against women. And I was going to say unbelievable, but actually, when you think about it, it's perfectly believable. A response from sex workers to some of their more violent clients. How do they go about protecting themselves in that environment, particularly when the work that they do is very often illegal? So they can't really go to the police because there are all sorts of other issues that might be involved in that. How do they protect themselves? And what do we do? What sort of tools are available to allow women to take control of their own situation when they might be experiencing violence, particularly domestic violence? Well, they're not even sure whether or not that's actually what they're experiencing, and they just want to get clear in their minds whether this is something they should actually be concerned about or not, because, of course, identifying the problem can be part of the problem itself sometimes, can't it? So that's the discussion we're going to have in the drawing room, which I'm really looking forward to a bit later in the program, so hang around for that. On the issue of violence, though, at the billionaire end, interesting text from Favela Dweller, as they call themselves, saying violence is normally meted out by the rich and powerful at the poor, often by using other poor folk to do the dirty work. The rich thumping the rich is so entertaining. Schadenfreude, you bet. It's fairly direct. Another text. The two Bondi combatants run media systems that report violence, often for its shock value. Ha, ha. Doesn't sound like anybody is backing away from their interest in this particularly. 0418 226 576 to join the conversation. And also very soon on the program, how horrible is that story that's been emerging over the past week or so out of Nigeria with those 230, up to 270 actually, schoolgirls who'd been kidnapped and taken away? We now know that the terrorist group Boko Haram have claimed responsibility for this. Who are they? What exactly is the background that has led us to this point? And the protests against the Nigerian government are interesting. What exactly are they about? Why is the government being blamed for this? And sorry, just a correction, they've been kidnapped for 3 weeks. That's how long this has been going on for. We're going to see if we can get some really valuable and rare background to this up on the program very soon. So stay tuned for that. 7 past 7. To WICAC first, it's been another dramatic day there. This is, of course, the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption. It's been looking into illegal donations to the Liberal Party. And what happens now is the commission's going to be suspended within a few weeks. And it's going to be suspended so it can investigate new allegations of electoral fraud that implicate the former police minister, Mike Gallagher. Lawyers, though, for the federal senator, Arthur Sinodinos, and the former energy minister, New South Wales, Chris Hartcher, are upset about this adjournment. They're objecting to this, saying that their names have been dragged through the mud for long enough and this will just prolong it. I'm joined now by Kate McClymont, investigative reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald, who's keeping across all of this. Kate, why are they suspending these proceedings?
Well, as a result of new evidence that came to light at the end of last week implicating the then Police Minister, Mike Gallagher, the inquiry is going to adjourn after the end of next week in order to properly explore these allegations. And for instance, the commissioner said, look, you don't understand. This is when, as you said, barristers got up and, you know, jumped up and down. She said things like issuing subpoenas to financial institutions to produce bank records takes weeks. So there are cogent reasons for doing this. But Arthur Sinodinos's barrister, Robert Newlands, was very upset about this, saying, you know, look, my client, Mr. Sinodinos, has stood down. His good name's been dragged through the mud. We want him to be dealt with immediately. And several other barristers made the same representations on behalf of their clients, particularly a group of Central Coast Liberal MPs who are worried about their standing with a state election due in March next year, because it now appears that any finding in this inquiry won't be handed down until Christmas. So that will seriously affect their chances of perhaps retaining pre-selection for their seats. But Commissioner Megan Latham, you know, batted all these off and said, look, I can't take into account, you know, political considerations. And she said, look, while she was mindful of reputational damage, it was important that these inquiries be held in the open and that the media go about doing their job as they can. And she said that these things are just unfortunate, but they did have to stop and examine these further allegations.
It was a regrettable byproduct, I think, was the word that was being used. It's an easy thing to say, but is it good enough? I mean, if at the end of this process these men are cleared, but they've suffered significant damage in the meantime, is there any way they can seek reparation for that?
No, not really. But I must say that it usually seems that the ICAC doesn't go down this track unless they have fairly good information in the first place. And in fact, with regard to Mike Gallagher, who resigned as police commissioner on Friday, his barrister, Arthur Moses, said to the counsel assisting Geoffrey Watson, now let me just understand this. You are alleging that my client is involved in, you know, electoral irregularities. Is that the case? Are you going to be making those allegations? And Geoffrey Watson responded, oh, yes. So you do get the feeling that ICAC sort of fairly much knows what it is alleging and where the inquiry is going beforehand.
And it's going to go big with this. That's the sense that
well,
I seem to be getting.
Yes. Yes, I think that you're right there.
So the Commissioner announced that the public hearings would resume in August, and she's going to produce her report in December. How flexible is that timeline?
Look, it is fairly flexible, and we will finish 8x5, which is a segment of this inquiry in relation to a slush fund run by a group of people out of the former Resources Minister Chris Hartch's office. So next week we will have the former coal magnate Nathan Tinkler in the box, followed by Chris Hartcher and that group of Central Coast MPs. Then the inquiry will adjourn, and it's likely that it will start on the 4th of August.
Just before I let you go, you might have seen suggestions around today, and I think yesterday as well, from the Greens at the federal level, saying that we need a federal ICAC. They wouldn't be the first to have suggested that this might be something that's good, and indeed some people have thought that there should be an ICAC in every jurisdiction around the country. You've been watching it up close. Do you think it would be relevant to the federal sphere, or are these issues actually very much state-based because of the relationship, particularly between property development and state government?
No, look, where decision makers are involved, there is always the opportunity and the inclination to corrupt people. And the state-based ICACs only have the ability to look into public servants in that state. There's no provision to look into Commonwealth public servants. So I just think that what's coming out of this inquiry, I'm sure, would be replicated throughout Australia in one way or another, and federal politics would not be any different, I would imagine.
Thank you very much for speaking to us, Kate.
My pleasure, Waleed.
Kate McClymont, gosh, she's going to be busy. a long time to come. If you're on the ICAC circuit, I think right now it looks like you've got a job for life, doesn't it? Investigative reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald. Actually, do you think we need a federal ICAC? I'd like to know whether or not you think it's relevant. Because the federal government is separate. I mean, it's kind of removed a little more from these sorts of business deals. But corruption is corruption, and I suppose it can happen anywhere. 0418226576. Do you look on at ICAC with envy if you're not from New South Wales and think, wouldn't it be great if this existed in my state? 0418226576 or Twitter at RNDrive. 13 past 7.
Allahu akbar kabiran kun ga moda bala'i sai mun bi Allah zamu bi Allah ku mutu da bakin take zamu bi Allah yan uwa ku yanka wuyan arna yan uwa ku kama bayi.
That we think is the voice of Abubakar Shekau, who's a leader of the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. This came from a videotape that's released where he's admitting the kidnap of 276 teenage schoolgirls. They disappeared from a school in the remote northeast 3 weeks ago. 53 have since managed to escape. But in this tape, he says that the girls as young as 9 would be sold for marriage, that he warned that his group plans to attack more schools and abduct more girls. So he's threatening more here. But the question is, who are Boko Haram exactly? Are they capable of following through on this threat? Who is Abubakar Shekau? Is that indeed even him? Can we verify that? And how did we get to this point? I'm joined now by Nimali Asia Rodrigo, who worked with the Islamic Education Trust NGO in Nigeria, and in that time specialised in research and training young Muslims to avoid extremism. She returned to Australia in December over a decade in Nigeria, and she joins us now. Asia, thank you very much for speaking to us today. You arrived in Nigeria in 2002. What did you see as far as Boko Haram was concerned then?
Well, not much, Waleed. At that time, there was just Muhammad Yusuf, and Muhammad Yusuf was a native of Borno State. He is now known as the leader of Boko Haram. But at that time, it wasn't really an organized group. It was just a young lad who preached that an ungodly society and an ungodly government should not be served. And he was very charismatic. He gained a lot of followers. He ran weekly classes around his ideology and naturally had a lot of sympathy among the local population, because people did feel very disgruntled. They felt their opportunities had been removed from them, and they had very little hope in the government.
So when he says an ungodly government should not be served, there are the seedlings at least of some kind of violent resistance to that. Was he actually talking violence at that point?
At that point, he wasn't. It was actually a non-violent protest, but he was sowing the seeds of rebellion, one would say. Now, he had a lot of followers, especially among youth groups, but again, it wasn't an organized group. He just had followers, and so he was known as Muhammad Yusuf, the local scholar, and he had his followers. Now, at a particular point in time, there was a politician running as a candidate for the governor of Borno State, Muhammad Yusuf's state. And this particular politician was said to have engaged in a deal with Muhammad Yusuf to support his youth movement in exchange for implementing Yusuf's model of Sharia and for appointing Yusuf's followers into certain political positions in this government. Now, this deal never actually followed through, and Yusuf then became very much more critical of the government hypocrisy and corruption. And as a result of this critique, this widespread critique, his popularity soared across a greater number of states.
So emboldened them to become, to move from this being this small group that wasn't particularly inherently violent to one that is now, well, clearly massively and very concerningly violent.
Well, the violence began after Muhammad Yusuf's death. In fact, he was running a lot of welfare programs. He was providing food and shelter for refugees, unemployed youth. He had his own movement, but again, it wasn't outright rebellion in terms of an armed resistance. Now, there was a particular funeral that took place in 2009. One of his followers was being buried, and in that particular procession, some of those followers were not wearing helmets. Now, there was a policy in the state of Borno at that time that everybody on a motorcycle needs to wear a helmet. But many people in Nigeria didn't do so at that time. Unfortunately, the police threatened that they would shoot these followers if they do not put on their helmets, and they didn't put on the helmets, and so they were shot. About one or two people died, and after that, people got a little bit more violent. But a lot of the violence was directed at the police, at military barracks, and so on. And the president at that time, the late president, Yar Adua, enacted an order that this particular movement should be quelled. And the police in the state engaged in a clean sweep, so to speak, and basically killed about what's said to be around 800 people at that time, not really discriminating against who belonged to this group and who didn't. And again, there was no formal resistance by the group. It was just an outright killing. At that time, Muhammad Yusuf was brought into custody, and again, there was an extrajudicial killing of Muhammad Yusuf while he was in custody. That led to a series of reprisal attacks, and a lot of his followers went underground. Now, after Muhammad Yusuf's death, his second in line, Abubakar Shekau, became the leader. And in 2010,
so this is the man that is allegedly in the video that we've seen today.
Yes, that's the same man. Now, this is the man who actually really organized the group into a military rebel group, a well-coordinated rebel group. So that happened in 2010. And he is very, very feared among his followers. He is known to be a little, well, very delusional, let's say. He's very highly feared and very, very dangerous.
So. Is he alive, though? Because I was reading about this today, that there were reports that he was dead, that this was an imposter, not this particular video, but in previous videos where he's turned up. What's actually true?
Yes, well, he's said to have had a third coming, actually. The government of Nigeria and the military reported that he died in 2009, and then again they reported he resurfaced, he had a second coming, and then he was reported to have died again in early 2013, and then he resurfaced after that. So we believe that this is Abubakar Shekau, who only was injured before and has now resurfaced, but seems to have resurfaced as a madman.
Well, the threats that they're making, that there will be more of this, they're talking about these girls as slaves, effectively, yeah, saying they'll be married off and so on and so forth. Do you think they'll follow through on that threat? I mean, is there any way that they can be stopped?
I think at this point it's very hard to stop them, only because they appear to be more highly coordinated and have greater intelligence than the Nigerian security forces, and that's really quite sad at the moment. They have a widespread network across the Sahel. Even though they have lost a lot of local support in Nigeria, they have gained international support in what's becoming a sort of terrorism industry among disenfranchised youth and their supporters. And there are lots of stockpiles of weapons that are across the Sahel at the moment that are being funneled into the web of Abubakar Shekau and his group.
So why can't the government respond to it? Why are they outgunned by this group?
The government's response has been very uncoordinated, very extreme in some cases. In the past, it was a very heavy-handed techniques being used, very widespread detention, extrajudicial killings, and there's also known to be a lot of impunity in the country, and so corruption is a very, very pervasive problem from bottom to top, and a lot of people have lost trust in the government, and they have no confidence in the political will of the country, of the country's leaders.
Well, so these protesters that we're seeing now that are protesting against the government, are you saying that they most likely believe that the government doesn't actually want to stop Boko Haram?
Well, there's a divide in the country about that. This is where Boko Haram has been very successful in exploiting the existing rifts in the country. For instance, there's a large segment of the southern population that believes that Boko Haram is a creation of northern leaders to oust a southern president. Whereas in the north, a lot of northern people believe that Boko Haram is a creation of the presidency and a lot of political leaders and their foreign allies to basically destabilize the north. So there's a lot of mutual suspicion, and I think this helps to fuel the fire that Boko Haram quite happily, you know, exploits.
And in the meantime, you've got these girls missing, and their fate, we don't know exactly what's going to happen to them. I know you don't have a crystal ball, and it's not your organisation. You wouldn't necessarily know what they're going to do. But can you foresee them following through with something truly horrific here, perhaps killing them?
Yes, I believe that some might have already been killed. Unfortunately, that's a sad reality. Some have not. But Boko Haram, Shekau in particular, is a very ruthless human being, a monster, in fact. He's very highly feared, and his followers would do anything to follow through on his orders, only because they are afraid of their own life as well. And the local population has set up a civilian joint task force. They have been quite effective in the city of Maiduguri. This is the capital of Borno State. And they are pushing Boko Haram to the fringes and to other local government areas and border areas. This is where Shekau is now operating from. However, there's little that they can do once Shekau crosses the border. So this is where international networks become very important. International cooperation becomes very important in really securing these girls. And the government of Nigeria also has to work very hard at winning back the population's confidence. The president has appeared very sluggish. He's appeared very uncertain and indecisive on this occasion. And at a time of crisis and insecurity, you know, every country expects that its commander-in-chief is going to reassure them that he or she is on top of the issue and will direct every possible resource at the disposal to combating this crisis. But in the case of Nigeria, the president's response has been very late and has left no confidence in people who are now preparing themselves for a possible war, you know, all-out war. And his latest address only serves to confirm that Boko Haram have got much better intelligence and have a game plan. They actually know what they're doing, and they have a means to exploit the existing fissures in the Nigerian society to get their way. And this is a real a tragedy of what's happening there. Activists are struggling very hard to advocate that Nigeria's people need to overcome this challenge and to unite around this a common struggle to retrieve these girls and not be caught up in the politics of fear and division. But unless the government really steps forward and has a concerted action towards eradicating itself of endemic corruption and impunity, and really going after, strategically going after these girls and securing the security of the people of the Northeast and the rest of Nigeria, then unfortunately, things don't look very good.
It's hardly encouraging, Asia. Thank you very much, though, for speaking to us, because it certainly is very insightful and important context. Namalia Asia Rodrigo, who worked with the Islamic Education Trust NGO in Nigeria for about a decade or so. 26 minutes past 7. Would you drink recycled water? You know, I've got news for you. I reckon you have. I reckon there's a fair chance you have. I'm talking about wastewater. It's been treated. Don't worry about that. But, it could be rainwater. It could be stormwater. It could be grey water. Yes. Yes, it could be effluent. Let's get that out of the way. I'm glad that's been aired now. We can all move on. So, would you be happy if that was coming out of your tap? Treated, of course. I reiterate. Dr. Stuart Khan joins us now. Water quality researcher, associate professor in environmental engineering at the University of New South Wales. Stuart will be giving a lecture in Adelaide tonight. A public lecture, and he's arguing it's an idea we've just got to get used to and we have to start now. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Waleed.
We have to do this, yeah?
We don't have to do it. We have choices in most of our cities that are on the coast, certainly. Our big cities have the option of seawater desalination, that the ocean's not going away. So the question is really about what is the most favourable option to do, and we should be answering that question by thinking about issues such as energy, and of course that means associated greenhouse gas emissions and carbon footprint. We should be taking into account cost. Absolutely, we should be taking into account, perhaps first and foremost, is safety of the drinking water supply system. We should also take into account community preferences. But we believe, after having undertaken the development of a report through the Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering, that water recycling, drinking recycled water, really stacks up very well against many of the other options that are available to us.
How so?
Well, there are different ways that we can recycle water for drinking, but some of them we can produce water that is of extremely high quality and certainly a higher quality than most of our drinking water suppliers at the moment, or really all of our surface water suppliers at the moment, higher levels of safety than those surface water suppliers. But if we're going to start having to produce water into our systems that are coming from high energy sources, such as seawater desalination, such as indirect potable water recycling, where we're pumping recycled water back into a reservoir or back into a groundwater supply, or such as long pipelines transferring water from one river basin catchment into another catchment, then we can really have some major energy savings.
So is that the big issue with, say, desalination, for example, is just that it's energy intensive?
Yes, so we talk about capital costs and operational costs, and desalination has significant capex and opex.
A lot of cities around the world do this, don't they? I'm pretty sure London has recycled water.
London has, they're talking about building a much larger scheme, but at the moment they do what we call unplanned indirect water recycling, which means that they take water from essentially from the Thames River via bank filtration and via groundwater. And into that waterway, into the Thames River, there are about 260 sewage treatment plants that discharge wastewater upstream. So it's not a designed water recycling scheme. There's no advanced treatment as we would normally expect to see in a planned water recycling system. But ultimately, they are drinking water that was previously wastewater. Other cities, there are some very large schemes in the US, in California and in Virginia, where they do what's called planned indirect water recycling. And that means that they've intentionally taken water from their wastewater treatment plant, their sewage treatment plant. They've added on advanced treatment processes and then use that water to recharge a traditional drinking water supplies. What we're talking about this evening largely is somewhat different again, that we refer to as direct water recycling. So we would actually take the water from the sewage treatment plant through an advanced treatment process, and then in a pipeline directly back into the drinking water supply. So it's a much more closed loop, and ultimately the water is more protected from environmental factors, and that's part of the improved water quality, and it's a large part of the energy savings as well, not having to pump water back out into an environmental reservoir.
Bang! Straight from the sewer to you. I can see the slogans now, Stuart. And this is part of the problem, isn't it? Because you mentioned community attitudes, and community attitudes in Australia, I think it has been tried. Some variant of recycled water has been debated in parts of the country. I think in Queensland there was a debate. Didn't go very well. We haven't done this. Other parts of the world have done some version of it. As far as I'm aware, we haven't.
Well, it's not quite true. We certainly have lots of unplanned water recycling systems. Many of our rivers contain effluent, and there are lots of examples of where there are drinking water suppliers that are taking water from rivers which have sewage effluent being discharged into it upstream. And there are examples in all of our capital cities, in fact. But we do also have a couple of planned indirect potable water recycling schemes. The city of Perth has just completed a three-year trial of using highly treated recycled water to recharge one of their main drinking water aquifers, the Leaderville aquifer. Most 60% of the drinking water in Perth comes from groundwater, and so they've recently had approval to expand that. It's currently under construction, and they're expecting to produce around about 20% of Perth's drinking water supply over the next 20 or 30 years.
Do all the people of Perth know this?
That's a good question. We certainly do point to Perth as a successful case study of where the water utility, Water Corporation, have been very effective in being open and transparent with the community. And at the moment, there does seem to be a very high level of community acceptance and community approval for the system. However, I don't know the direct answer to your question about if you were to knock on random doors in Perth and ask people if they're aware of their future drinking water supply being partially
provided by indirect potable reuse. I'm not sure exactly how high the awareness levels are.
Well, if you're in Perth, let me know. 0418 226 576. Did you know about this, and does it frighten you? And it's the psychological aspect that it comes down to, isn't it, Stuart? Because I remember there was a case a couple of weeks ago in somewhere in the United States where someone was caught on film urinating into what was effectively going to become a water supply. It would have had no impact on whether or not this was drinkable water or the treatment, but nonetheless, the authorities decided that, well, they would quarantine that off and not use it.
Yes, that's right. So that's Portland is the city where that happened, and a young man was filmed in the middle of the night. They were riding skateboards around the reservoir, and one of them decided to relieve himself into the reservoir. And as you say, the public health implications of that are absolutely negligible. However, the community perception of the source of, in this case, an extremely small proportion of their drinking water having been excreted by another person is repulsive to many people, and there's a good reason, I think. I think that there are good evolutionary reasons for why we are repulsed by the idea of coming into contact with human excrement or with water that may have been tainted by human excrement. And that's certainly a challenge that we need to manage in helping people to understand that, yes, it does make sense to be repulsed by some circumstances where we might come into contact with a very dangerous disease-causing medium, but that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with highly purified water. We're dealing with some of the purest, cleanest water available on the planet.
Yeah, but is it a tax? Sorry, that's a separate interview. I got confused, Stuart. Thank you very much for speaking to us. I imagine you might need to get someone from marketing on board to help you tonight. We'll see how you go.
Thanks, Walid. I appreciate it.
Dr. Stuart Kahn, a water quality researcher, associate professor in environmental engineering at the University of New South Wales. Would you drink it? 0418 226 576. Twitter at RNDrive.
Do you drive across or even out of town to see that special limited release film? Do you go with the crowds in the multiplex or hit the couch with the DVD? Lots of options, one film program. The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso. Talking about movies that matter, big or small, and the people who make them. The Final Cut, Thursday nights at 9:45, just before that Australian film legend, Philip Adams, and Saturdays after 2.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Tech Tuesday time. Did you notice last week the federal government announced it's going to water down legislation aimed at stamping out cyberbullying? They went into the federal election last year promising to appoint a national cyberbullying commissioner that'd have the power to take down material deemed to be bullying from the internet. Then there was intense lobbying from social media sites, and the commissioner now is focusing only on bullying against children, not adults. I'm joined by Claire Porter, freelance technology journalist, editor of at large of techly.com.au and PC Mag Australia. Claire, how would this work?
It would work by basically ensuring that anyone who commits cyberbullying could be subject to a civil offence rather than a criminal offence. Paul Fletcher, who is the communications secretary to Malcolm Turnbull, received a lot of submissions to a discussion paper that was put out earlier this year. And their concern was, while cyberbullying is obviously a very serious offence and it can cause severe mental damage or emotional damage to the people who are the victims of it, they were concerned about what would happen to children once they entered the criminal system. Because surely, yes, cyberbullying is horrific, but you know, God forbid you get caught and then thrown in jail, all of a sudden you come out learning how to hotwire a car, it may be counterproductive to what you're actually trying to achieve.
I see. But it also seems to be not just about crime and those sorts of issues, but also free speech. Because Paul Fletcher, who's parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Communications, said that free speech is a vitally important issue. We've sought to carefully limit any impact on it. Are you talking in the context here of cyberbullying? Why is that a free speech issue?
Well, at the moment, the government is actually trying to repeal Section 18C of Australia's racial discrimination laws, which basically currently makes it illegal to discriminate against someone on the basis of race. The government, Tony Abbott, and our Attorney General, George Brandis, have been particularly concerned about the limitations this places on free speech, and Brandis himself has actually defended all Australians' right to be a bigot, quote-unquote. So when this legislation came to be discussed, the original intent was to perhaps have it be aimed not just at children, but anyone, whether they're a minor or not. But since we've had discussions on the matter, it's been decided that unless you're under the age of 18, this new law will not apply. The idea would be that you'd get charged, you know, $1,000, maybe $2,000 and a civil offence for cyberbullying. But what happens if that content is racist? Surely there's a bit of a conflict between what Paul Fletcher is trying to achieve and what the Attorney General and the Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, is trying to achieve. They seem to be at ends with each other.
I suppose you just get whacked under the cyberbullying legislation but not under the Racial Discrimination Act if it's been amended. I guess that's what happens. But the focus on the kids, on it being on kids, is interesting because we've seen some very high-profile examples of cyberbullying that have had tragic consequences, potentially. At least it seems that way, the case of Charlotte Dawson being an example.
Yeah, that was tragic. There's actually a petition going around at the moment to have these laws go even further and to ensure that it applies to adults. But that's when this kind of issue starts to encroach on free speech territory. And I think that's when the government decided that it would actually cause too much of a conflict within their own party to be able to do anything about. And I think it makes sense to be able to educate kids about what is and is not acceptable behaviour online. What I find hard to stomach is the idea that up until you turn the age 18, you've got this current fear of, you know, either a $2,000, $3,000 fine or a $1,000 fine for something that you've said that's cruel to another child online, and perhaps that will come with a civil offence. But once you turn 18, you're fine. Go for it. Racist? No worries. You've got right to free speech once you turn 18.
Yeah, as long as the adults are fine, I'm fine with it, Claire.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, but it seems to be a bit of a conflict within the government, and I'd like to see them come forward and talk a little bit more about exactly how this would apply both for adults and children, because we haven't yet heard all the
details. Maybe they will clarify. Thank you very much, Claire. Appreciate it. Drawing room time, 21 to 8. Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
Right in the drawing room, what do you do about violence against women? And when I say what do, I suppose I mean what do we all do? But also, what do women do? How do they help themselves out in this situation? Because they, of course, have their agency and they have their responses. And some of those responses might surprise you. Certainly surprised me, although when I thought about it, it made perfect sense. What am I talking about? Well, I have guests here to tell me exactly what I'm talking about. Peta Brady is one of them. She's an actress. You might know her for roles in Neighbours and The Slap. But she has another job as a drug and safety officer in St Kilda, which I think she was doing for something in the vicinity of about 15 years. And she joins us now. She's turned some of those experiences and her insights that she gained in that role into an artistic work. She joins us now along with Professor Kelsey Hegarty, who's developed a trial web-based project which is aimed at providing support for victims of domestic violence. Different perspectives, but a very, very united and powerful theme that they're here to discuss. Thank you very much for dropping by, both of you.
Thank you.
Peter, I'm just going to ask you to tell us what Ugly Mugs is.
Ugly Mugs is is used as a crime prevention strategy for the working girls or working boys, transgender, anyone who's working really, who's on the street mostly. And it's a way of letting us know or letting each other know who's out there, what violent clients they might have. And that gets sort of recorded into a pamphlet that they can sort of pass around to each other on the street just so they know who's out there. It has sort of description in there, like 5'3", blue Commodore, broken windscreen wiper, as much information as you can get with a registration number if you can get it. And so then people can advocate for them with police, because there's sometimes always a barrier in the way of reporting crime to police, because they might have legal issues. It might be a stressful time for them. It might take too long. There's also sort of a lot of barriers. And because the work is criminalised in Victoria on the street, then that's another barrier between police.
Right. So to be clear, in case anyone's not clear what we're talking about, we're talking about sex workers.
We're talking about sex workers, yeah.
And the fact that their work is sometimes with people who are seriously dangerous.
Yeah, people. Majority are really friendly, but there are clients out there that do want to do harm.
Whose idea was this?
It was from the old prostitute collective when we said prostitute in 1986. I think they started the program.
It's a really, it's an intuitive idea when you think about it.
Yeah,
but I'd never thought about this as being something that would exist—a kind of underground document telling you who to steer clear of.
Yeah. It's sort of just a way to let everybody know who's out there and let each other know who's out there.
Mm. Does it work?
Yeah, there's been a few cases that have come through. Last year someone got caught through the Ugly Mug program. So, yeah, when it's police can get on board and trace things, yeah.
But what's the principal aim here? Is it to catch people or is it just to allow sex workers to steer clear? I know that car. That car's on in the document.
Yeah, it's prevention, I think. A lot of the girls just want to let the next girl know because they're quite a close community and some people want it to be advocated and taken it further with police. And
the question it immediately raises for me is, how did you decide, or how do you decide when someone goes in? Like, what sort of experience?
It's really up to them if they want to take it further with police, or whether they just want to let the other girls know what's happened.
So they've been assaulted, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And they may not want to go to police because they could end up in.
Well, yeah. Well, they might have other issues that they can't really sort of just go in there and walk and say what happened.
Kelsey, your work is not quite in this arena.
No,
it's a different sort of thing. But how common is that thread or that theme of women who are suffering from violence having other reasons why they don't want to talk to someone about it because they might be implicated in something or the rebound effects that they're anticipating might be too much?
It's extremely common, and women don't talk about it for lots of reasons. One is they fear that their partner, because my area is mostly domestic violence, that their partner might take retribution, you know, if they find out they've talked to their doctor. You know, I'm a GP, that sort of a thing. But also, yeah, certainly for migrant and refugee women, you know, the fact that they might be on a visa and if they leave their partner, then that's an issue. But women often have trouble naming or being able to say what I'm experiencing is domestic violence. Whereas, you know, it sounds like the sex workers obviously know if they've been assaulted. But when...
Well, maybe they don't. I mean, I don't know. You'd know better than me, Peter. But I imagine there are kind of fuzzy boundaries at times where they may not be sure, does this constitute an assault? Yeah, is this proper, maybe. Is this not?
I suppose, the health service that I work for too have a lot of sex workers that work with us, so there's a lot of sort of peer education as well and sharing what's safe and a safer way to work.
And what they can accept and what they shouldn't
be. Yeah, and what's unacceptable, yeah.
But when it's your loved one who's doing it to you.
Yeah, it's totally
It's someone that you probably fell in love with, maybe had children with, and of course there's physical violence, but many women say it's the emotional abuse and the controlling tactics that they find the most difficult. And
so what are they scared of when they don't want to report?
They're scared, I think, to say it out loud in some instances, to actually say...
To acknowledge it even.
Yeah, you know, and that's what the online support tool is doing, is getting them to self-reflect on what's happening in their relationships. Is that normal? Is that okay? And, the answer in most cases is no. So I think that women, in the first case, are thinking that perhaps they don't want to say it out loud, but they also fear judgmental responses.
Yeah.
Particularly from professional services, and sometimes they've had them. And the third area is they probably turn to family and friends the most. But, of course, often the person using the violence and the controlling tactics has isolated them from their family and friends. Mm. And that's part of the abuse.
Well, they're within the family and they have family. And so, it becomes a very difficult thing to escape.
Yeah.
Was there a problem with stigma amongst sex workers as well, as far as violent clients were concerned?
Yeah, and I think that all is embedded within the law a bit because it's criminalised, so it sort of all sort of comes from there. It comes from the top. They are other. They're ruled by different laws. They've got not the same rights as me.
It's extra barriers, isn't it?
So you mentioned you're a GP.
Yes.
And I know GPs are a real focus for you.
Yes.
As far as dealing with domestic violence is concerned. Why is that?
Well, they're probably the professional group that women tell the most. It's accessible. Women are allowed to go to the doctor. They also go to the doctor quite a lot. There's confidentiality. A whole range of reasons why the GP might be quite a good site. And also there's early intervention there because they see a range of women. And I think the online resource is trying to reach out to women who aren't seeing specialist services, because those people have named and they are aware. So the healthy relationship tool, which we called I Decide, actually, you mentioned Decide.
And can I've got to confess, when I saw I Decide written down, for some reason I immediately said Deicide, which is a completely different concept.
Yes. Don't say that.
A much heavier concept. For some reason, that's what I saw.
So we've tried that out with some survivors and they really like it because they want to be empowered. I Decide about my relationship.
Yeah,
they see it as an empowering thing. And we're basing it on the idea from a theory that if women are aware and they can feel more confident to do something, more self-efficacious, and they can also feel supported. And, you know, can you be supported by a computer? I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, maybe, to some extent. If you've got nothing else that's telling you that, or suggesting or helping you with this area.
Well, as Peter, though, in the case of Ugly Mugs, the question, how did you know or how do you know when to put someone in the document? I suppose, Kelsey, it's a similar sort of question here. How do you even think to use an online tool? What is the trigger that makes you go, this is something I need to find out?
Okay. And this is quite complex because if you said, come and look at a domestic violence site, got the same problem.
Exactly.
So the current way we're using it is to advertise for people who feel unsafe in their relationships or fearful in their relationships. And I did a large trial last year where we screened in general practice and about 12% of women attending general practice were afraid of their partner or ex-partner in the last 12 months.
Really? Mm.
So it's a huge, that's just women sitting in the waiting room who we screened. So I think that there's a lot of women out there who will respond to the idea of a feeling like fear, which you can, you know, name, as opposed to labelling yourself as a domestic violence.
So what do you ask? Are you scared of something?
Yeah. Are you scared of your partner?
So you can be that direct?
Yeah. Are you afraid of your partner? Are you feeling safe in your relationship? And women will answer those questions quite easily and come into the trial.
You're in the drawing room. That's the voice of Professor Kelsey Hegarty. She's my guest along with Peter Brady, who was telling us about a document called Ugly Mugs, but that's not the only thing in the world that's called Ugly Mugs. It's also a theatre piece, which she's put together. How did you do that? Well, the why I can probably understand relatively easily, but how do you do that
and how is it not so depressing and morbid or something?
I've written about, it's not just about sex workers, it's about violence in the community. So there's just a girl sort of playing in the park, playing footy, and she cops a whack in the head from a rock that she doesn't know what's come from. So that sort of strand of the story meets a working girl out and having an ugly mug event kind of happens.
Interaction with a client who's in ugly mugs?
Yeah. So the story sort of touched at one point, and I've sort of just used the ugly mugs as a sort of backdrop of information through a pathologist who's within the play. So he discovers this ugly mug and sort of so we can discover it with him and find out what is this sort of pamphlet, and sort of he's trying to piece together what happened to working girl who has a bit of a bad demise in my play. So, yeah, it's just sort of we learn what the actual document is within the play. It's not taken from anyone's direct experiences. I didn't take anyone's story. I've just sort of taken the territory and the language that is usually in the Ugly Mugs reports and made up my own version.
Who's the hero of the piece?
The heroine.
Hero.
Yeah.
I thought we were past that point. You know, there was a point I got told off once for using the word actress.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, because an actress is just an actor.
Yeah.
A hero, is a heroine just a hero now?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my excuse. I'm sticking with that
for now. Yeah. I thought it was interesting because when I first started the play, I thought it was definitely a story about two women's experiences with a violent encounter. But as we've sort of been rehearsing, I've put a younger violator in it, who plays son, and it sort of seems to be revealing that it's the son's sort of story. There is a hero in
the son's also the villain.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a kind of interesting thing because we're sort of liking this person. Sometimes the perpetrator is someone really, really likable and we see what they do. Mm. But they're still charming and they can still be funny and they, you know.
Which I imagine, Kelsey, resonates very strongly with what you see.
Why women struggle to name it. But
it's not always straight in your face and obvious.
It's very complex.
Yeah.
What can you do about that?
Well, I think that, as I said, I think often if someone's grown up in a family where that's the norm, I think women do struggle to, as I said before, work out what is the norm. So I think by reading a list of behaviours and getting some feedback about those behaviours, thinking about their danger, because the online tool is a safety decision aid, they then go on and prioritise what they see as the most important thing for them right now. And one of them is feelings for their partner. Some of it might be getting resources. Often it's the safety and well-being of their children, which is a great motivator, you know, for them to try and do something. But also their own safety and health and well-being. And sometimes they have to become healthier to be able to action something or do something. And that, so therefore the tool actually gives them a whole set of strategies in each of those areas to try and assist them on their pathway or journey to safety and better life.
So they've accessed this tool online. So it's, I'm imagining like a questionnaire type scenario where they go through and do, you know, at the end of it they get a result as to whether or not they should be.
Yeah, I think it's more tailored than that. It's been trialled in the States. It comes out of Johns Hopkins University and we're just beginning ours. And it's more tailored and interactive than that. So they do answer a few questions and then it might say, you know, it seems to me that you're experiencing a lot of behaviours that we would call abuse. That's not acceptable in relationships. How do you feel about that? So it's mimicking what I tried to teach the general practitioners to do in the trial I ran last year, where we did make a difference to the safety discussion and whether women were depressed. So it's the idea that's the face-to-face interactions that a counsellor or a GP or someone might have could actually be mimicked to some extent.
In some ways, because it's anonymous, it might be even easier.
It will get a different group of women. It will get, and particularly, say, for rural women where, you know, the GP's the friend of the partner and, you know, we think it'll be particularly good for rural women.
That's the same. Well, Ugly Mugs is now a worldwide program. It's not just in Australia. That other countries have taken that up and they've become on a more database where you can do it online and report things online and get your alerts as an SMS on your mobile. And
oh, really?
Yeah. So I suppose it's just moving with the times and goes to internet instead of sometimes it's the only way to sort of capture someone.
Well, I think we're also moving towards developing an app for family and friends to see what they would say. You know, they just don't have the words or the resources or the, you know, so it could just be those straight things. But I think this idea that it's interactive and tailored, we're hoping we'll be able to come back and tell you.
So this is very much an above ground thing. You want everybody to know about it and access it and so on.
Mm.
Is Ugly Mugs like that?
Not really. It's not sort of a public publication. It's not put out in public places. It's put out into a lot of services and needle exchanges and health services, but you probably might have to know where to go to get it or ask for it. Because
The whole thing's underground.
Yeah, it's because it's not a statement as such and it could be defamatory maybe they got a registration wrong or something. You know, there could be complications in having it just because we used to put it all over the walls and stuff and or the front door of the place where we worked. So people walking past on the street could read it, but now it has to be all taken down.
So when you say we, tell us about your interaction with this world.
The Ugly Mugs program is a program within the place I work. I work at Inner South and we have a lot of programs. So my division is the Mobile Health Outreach Service. So I'm just in the car giving out condoms and fits and lube and all the sort of work, the equipment that makes work safer. And the Ugly Mugs publication, we sort of distribute that and see if anyone's got anything to report while they're out.
Is this the normal trajectory for a neighbour's starlet?
Yeah. You'd be surprised how many actors are out there sort of working at the Salvation Army or somewhere, you know, somewhere. I've bumped into a couple, but, yeah, no, probably not. No, don't have a...
Which one was Delta Goodrum working on?
Maybe it's the fickle nature
you
of
caught
acting.
Me.
when your parents said you need something to fall back on, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's that in mind.
Yeah, maybe. It's very, very fun, and the girls are a lot of fun. I mean, I'm talking about quite a gloomy, doomy subject, but the interactions with the girls on the street can be very funny, and I've had such a great time and learnt so much from them. So it's kind of not a job that sort of gets me down a lot, as people might presume it does. Yeah.
And the same with working with survivors to develop this app is just so great.
Yeah.
You know, and they've had really awful experiences. And I always sort of say at the beginning of talks, I hope whatever I say is empathic to anybody's survivor's experience in the audience, because they are the ones who know.
Yeah.
And so whatever we develop, it needs to be informed, and I try to make it that way.
Yeah. How did you end up there, though? Was it before or after acting? Was it? Is it all at the same time? How did it work?
It was after Neighbours and stuff like that. The Neighbours tour van that goes to Ramsay Street leaves from across the road from the Needle Exchange in St Kilda, where I was stand at the window and trying not to wave.
Well, in case the hordes of British tourists come out.
Yeah, it's just funny to watch them go after you've done the show, and then you see them all get in the bus and you're sort of sitting in a different little fragment of life. And
Completely.
Yeah, it's a nice little juxtaposition.
I imagine.
I think I just started working in Needle Exchange 15 years ago, and then they trained me up and I got my drug and alcohol certificate and all that sort of stuff, and just started working for other programs because all the sort of community ventures sort of work together. And so just kind of moved between and stayed there forever. I kept doing little jobs and then just finding my way back there, and then finding another little dribbly job and then going back there.
So you have to, when Home and Away knock on the door, you'll have to
pack my bags.
Possibly.
But for the 2 weeks and be back.
That's right. But in the meantime, you were in the theatre.
I am.
Specifically the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne, and Ugly Mugs is the play. It's running from the 16th of May through to the 7th of June, and then it's off to Sydney, where it's in the Griffin Theatre from the 18th of July through to the 23rd of August, if you would like to see it. Kelsey, are people interested in the service you're providing? How do they find it?
Yeah, so we're going to be advertising in a whole variety of places like Gumtree, eBay, and it will say, I decide about my relationship. How safe do you feel in your relationships? And we'd love anybody out there who has had that experience to help us develop this online tool up.
And then at the end of all that, you just Google it or something.
Eventually it will be hosted. We've got partners with Domestic Violence Resource Centre, Victoria, and Berry Street and Drummond Street. Ultimately, it will be housed somewhere.
I decide. Keep an eye out for it. It's a project that Professor Kelsey Hegarty is working on. My guest in the drawing room, along with Peter Brady, whose play Ugly Mugs is running in Melbourne and Sydney. Thank you very much for dropping by, both of you.
Thank you.
That's it. I'm off. 6 o'clock tomorrow. It's a date. Bye.
Now available as an All in the Mind podcast, The Psychopath Within.
So I'm like a borderline pro-social psychopath, I guess, but I'm a lucky one.
And can we treat kids who may be headed down the psychopathic path?
So there's children lacking in empathy, cold, tending to use predatory type bullying and aggression. And if something goes wrong, they just don't care.
The Psychopath Within on All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm. You can download or stream the program from the RN website.